today on Building on the Solid Rock with Pastor Troy Neely.
It's not her faith as in, I believe. Her faith had a point of contact. There was a way for her to exercise and demonstrate her faith. This woman got to Jesus despite the crowd pressed in, though she could be beaten, killed for her act. She risked everything because she believed in him. How do we know that? Because she believed? No, because she did.
Deeper and deeper, deeper and deeper, I want to know you.
Many people in the church say they have faith. However, their actions, or lack thereof, reveal that they are consumed with doubt. Do your actions show that you have faith in Christ's power? God can do amazing things with even a mustard seed amount of faith. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. Now make sure and stay with us after Pastor Troy's message. I want to share our contact information with you, as well as how you can receive a free copy of today's broadcast. Now open your Bibles to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 9, verse 12. Let's join Pastor Troy for part one of our message entitled, Jesus Restores Life.
Now Jesus has just said in Matthew chapter 9, verse 12, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. In other words, the religious leaders who say, why are you hanging out with these sinners? He said, well, because how am I going to minister to them if I'm not around them? I came to them. I'm going to be around them. And now Matthew is continuing building the case that Jesus is the Messiah, the one who came, the one who was promised. He's shown him and his authority over nature, his authority to teach the scriptures, his authority over, and he continues to show cases where Jesus is healing. He has power over even death and sickness. And so he builds his case, and today we see that Jesus restores life. Some may feel hopeless this morning, like you're in a situation that it's just not going to get better. I've lost hope. I'm beyond hope. But Jesus restores hope, emotional life. Jesus restores life. Some may feel that their life is beyond fixing. It just is what it is. I've made a mess, and Jesus restores life. And some feel that life has no meaning. Maybe you've accomplished great goals. You've done great things in the world, and it all has come to mean nothing. What's this all about? Well, Jesus comes to restore spiritual life. Life. And so we want to see that he does that and how he does it in our text today, verse 18. While he, that's Jesus, spoke these things, what things? He was talking about old wine in new wineskins, that the old religion isn't going to work anymore because it's a work of my grace, and my grace doesn't fit in the context of the religious system. And so he spoke these things to them, and as he did, behold, a ruler came and worshiped him, saying, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her, and she will live. So Jesus arose and followed him, and so did his disciples. And suddenly a woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years came from behind and touched the hem of his garment. For she said to herself, if only I may touch his garment, I shall be made well. But Jesus turned around, and when he saw her, he said, be of good cheer, daughter, your faith has made you well. And the woman was made well from that hour. When Jesus came into the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd wailing, he said to them, make room, the girl is not dead but sleeping. And they ridiculed him. But when the crowd was put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl arose. And the report of this went out into all that land. Now, Matthew is writing to a Jewish audience, and he leaves out a lot of details here, and we're going to pick up those details as we look at another gospel with this same event. But Matthew's writing for the sake of showing that Jesus is the Messiah. So the fact that the miracles were done were all that were important to him. We're going to look at Mark's gospel, and we're going to see that there's more to the story. And it's important information for us as Christians today, especially in the context of our study, Restoring Life. Turn to Mark chapter 5. It's the next book to your right, Matthew, Mark, chapter 5, verse 21. We're going to follow his account, so just stay here with me. Mark chapter 5, beginning in verse 21. Now, when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea. And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed, and she will live." So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. That means they were so tight around him, there was not a lot of room. You know, a great crowd. Like today, if they didn't have those barriers, movie stars and those elite individuals that people idolize, they would be thronged. And so, Jesus was very famous. They were already lifting him up, admiring him, and they wanted to be close to him. We see a few things in Mark's gospel that we didn't get from Matthew's because of the detail added. And we know that his name is Jairus. We also know that he was a ruler of the synagogue. That was the guy who basically oversaw the synagogue activities. He administrated the synagogue, oversaw it. So he was a significant person in the Jewish world and in Judaism. We also see that his daughter, when he left, was not yet dead. When he left, she was dying, she was near death, but not yet dead. And so, don't you realize that this man, as he approaches Jesus, he's in a hurry. He's desperate. And he wants to come to him. And he begs him. But there's a delay. He begs him. Jesus goes. You know this guy wants to get Jesus and get him there. But there's a delay. Read this, Mark chapter 5, verse 25. Now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." This woman was one who had exhausted her resources. She had no hope except in one person, and that was Jesus. She had no hope in anything and anyone else. She had no hope in her money. She had no hope in her own ability to do this. She had no hope in doctors anymore because she tried them all. And she's desperate. And she decides, if I can just touch him, I know he heals people. I know he touches them. And if I can just touch him, there's a problem. Well, one, she has a flow of blood that makes her unclean by Jewish custom, the Jewish law. She's unclean. She cannot touch or be touched by somebody who is clean. She can't go to the synagogue services. She can't be around God. By the religion of the day, she couldn't come close to God. And she looks to Jesus and she says, If I could just touch the hem of his garment. Physicians had experimented on this woman. If you've been in the medical system at all, you know what that's like. She had spent all she had, and she just wants to touch him. But she knows she's unclean. She has no access to God. She can't touch him ethically. So she thinks in her mind, if I could just touch his garment, I don't have to touch him, but if I could just touch his garment, anything, then I could be made well. She just wants access to him. So she does the best she can to reach out without actually touching him. In Mark Verse 29, immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself the power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude thronging you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, she was fearing because she knew she had done the wrong thing. An unclean person touching him, this important figure. Fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." Now, we're going to talk a little more about this faith. We'll reference her again next week, the faith that made her well. Let me just say, briefly, we'll go into more detail next time, but it's not her faith as in, "I believe, I believe, I believe, I believe." Her faith had a point of contact. There was a way for her to exercise and demonstrate her faith. This woman got to Jesus despite the crowd pressed in, though she could be beaten, killed for her act. She risked everything because she believed in him. How do we know that? Because she believed? No, because she did. And this act of faith is what Jesus is talking about. Your faith, the faith that caused you to do, and to do in the sense that you trust me. You trust me so much, you did this. You came to me. That faith, that's made you well. Her faith in him. Jesus has mercy on her. He doesn't rebuke her. She couldn't have handled rebuke. She was hopeless. And so Jesus took this woman who had no hope, who everyone else had cast aside, and he speaks only kindness and says, "Your faith has made you well. You did it. You believed. You believed in me and you came to me. Your faith has made you well." Now, you got to contrast her a little bit with the ruler of the synagogue, because the ruler of synagogue has come to him and begged him, "Come, my daughter's dying near the point of death. Come on." Jesus stops for this woman and gives his whole attention. And he delays from the perspective of the ruler of the synagogue. Now, this man has a fading hope, but he still has some. So Jesus restores hope. Jesus is gentle to the hopeless, but the hopeless need to press in. They need to come. They need to act. It's not just this matter of, "Well, I believe Jesus can, but I'm hopeless. I'm not doing anything." That's not faith. Faith is exercised in when you're at the end of your resources, when you're at the end of everything, you follow, you press in, you come to Jesus. And Jesus did it according to her faith that caused her to press in. But different story for Jairus. There's a delay. Can you imagine Jairus, a religious leader, ruler of the synagogue? She's unclean. I'm bringing him to my situation, and we stop for this. He must have been frustrated. And with the delay, news comes. Not good news either. Mark 5:35. While he was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter's dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" Maybe they came because they were religious leaders too. They didn't want Jesus to have anything to do with this situation. They didn't like Jesus. Now, this man may have been on their side, but he was desperate. Said, "Yeah, maybe we're against him. Maybe we don't like what he's doing, but I've seen his healings. And I have a situation now." This is where rubber meets the road. Real life comes. He says, "Look, I don't care about all the games right now. This man can heal my daughter. I'm going to him." And so he approaches Jesus, but Jesus delays. This ruler of the synagogue was a prominent man, probably used to receiving priority and favor. Maybe he expected that Jesus would hurry. As a ruler of the synagogue, I imagine it was very difficult for him to come to Jesus at all, especially to beg. But he did it. He humbled himself. Something was more important than his religion, his pride, and everything that he was holding on to or putting value to. And he knew the only source he had may be this Jesus. So this man goes from humbly approaching Jesus with little hope. He had a little hope because he had hope in himself. If I can just bring him back here, I can get this done. I can take care of my daughter. Little hope to finally having no hope. She's dead. Don't trouble her any further. She's dead. In other words, time doesn't matter. There's nothing you can do now. That was his situation. But Jesus. Mark 5:36. As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." What does he mean when he says, "only believe"? Well, the man came with a certain amount of belief, but some of that belief was still in his own ability. I can take care of her. I can get this done. I can get Jesus. I can bring him back. Maybe I can use my clout. Maybe I can use my weight. He's consistently being humbled. There's a delay. Then he hears news. She's gone. And then Jesus says, when everything is gone, he says, "Now believe. You believed in me when you came. You believed I could do it. But now that it looks totally disadvantageous, like nothing can be done, I want you to have that kind of faith in me. Believe." And he asks the man to have faith. And he does. And it pays off. Mark 5:37. And he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him. Now that sounds kind of weird, right? He shows up, they're wailing because of the death of someone. And then Jesus says, "Hey, she's only asleep." And then they all start ridiculing him. Actually, the word is they began to laugh at him. And you think, that sounds weird. Seem like they'd be angry. Well, we'll explain why they might laugh at him. But it's not like Jesus went and made a mistake and they all laughed at him. Like Jesus shows up and goes, she's sleeping. And Peter whispers in his ear, "No, Jesus, she's dead." "She's dead." And then they all started laughing. He didn't even know she was dead. No, it's not about that. You know, Jesus said about Lazarus when he was really dead that he was sleeping as well. He told his disciples, "We need to go see Lazarus. He sleeps." And the disciples said, "Well, if he sleeps, he's going to get better." And Jesus finally said to them, "No, he's dead." Why would he say she sleeps? Why would he say of Lazarus, "He sleeps," when he's dead, when she's dead? Because for Jesus and from his perspective, death is to be no more feared than sleeping. To him, it's the same thing. Now, the difference is when you sleep, on our terms, we sleep, we wake up. For Jesus, it's the body's down, but it's resurrected. It's no big deal to him. That's a big deal to us. We know what sleeping's like. It rejuvenates us. When you're older, you appreciate sleep. You know, when you're younger, you got a lot more life to live. You don't like naps. So they tell you, you're going to take a nap, and there's like this fight against it. You don't want to take the nap. But as you get older, you begin to appreciate. If somebody tells you it's a nap, it's no longer a curse. That's a blessing. It's a gift from God. You're going to take a nap. A nap, can we? Oh, God bless you. Well, for us, as we mature in our faith, death is seen the same way. As we understand the resurrection, as we understand that to be dead here is to be alive to Christ, to be with him, death no longer has that grip of fear over us. We look for that day. We don't hasten the day. We don't make it happen. That's not given to us. This guy's got a purpose for us here. But we don't look at it with the same sense of dread, but with a sense of anticipation. Not the process of death. No one looks forward to that. But the death itself and being with him, we look forward to. So there's this crowd here. Jesus says she's sleeping, and they ridicule him. Why is that? Well, because most of the people gathered were probably not friends and family who actually cried over the girl. What they would do in Israel is death was expressed differently there, still is expressed differently there in the Middle Eastern countries than it is here. Over here, for some reason, it's undignified to wail and to cry out loud. We suppress everything. And I think it's why we have the highest level of stress, and we take the most stress medications, and we, you know, for such a rich nation, we're like the worst off medically. And I think it's because we suppress everything. It's just not matured. Don't cry, you know. Just hold it in. You're at the funeral. Yeah, I know she's up there, yeah. But over there, they wailed. They had a sense of belief that you went to be with your family, with your fathers. So they had this sense of resurrection, except the Sadducees, who dismissed all of that. But they had the same sense, but they wailed. They let it out. They mourned for a period of time. You were in mourning. You were supposed to mourn. It was expected that you would mourn. You dressed like you were in mourning. You looked like you were in mourning. You didn't have to put your makeup on and look all nice. You're mourning. They said, mourn. It's sad. We could learn a little something about that. Letting ourselves grieve. Letting ourselves hurt. You know why? Because it hurts. You let it out. There's nothing wrong with crying, men or women, for the right things. We should be crying about sin. We should be crying that there are family members who are not saved because they're going to hell. We should mourn. We, as Christians, should be shedding more tears than anyone. We have hope. We don't cry because we don't have hope. We shed tears because we're broken. This is a lost world. And we need a little more emotion about that. So this crowd, this expressive crowd, the reason they would laugh is because part of what they would do in this culture was they would hire other mourners. It did a couple of things. One, they would hire mourners because it added to the noise and allowed the family to wail and to let it out. It kind of covered the fact that it is hard. It's human nature to go, I don't want everyone to see me so broken. And so these wailers would kind of permit the family to wail, and then there's just this tumult. There's just chaos. There's crying and there's wailing, and you feel free to do it. You blend in with everyone else around you. And so this group of hired or participating mourners were the ones, because surely it wasn't friends and family. I mean, if someone came and said, oh, they're just sleeping, you wouldn't go, no, they're dead. You'd go, what do you mean they're asleep? They're dead. Don't you ever. That's a cruel joke. You know, we'd get upset. But the crowd turns and they begin to laugh because they're not as emotionally, or they're not even emotionally connected. That's why the laughing. They were professional mourners. So Jesus dismisses all of this. He puts them all out. Continuing on in Mark chapter 5, verse 40. But when he had put them all outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him and entered where the child was lying. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, Talitha kumi, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, arise. Immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age.
Deeper and deeper, deeper and deeper, I want to know you more.
In this day and age in which we live, it's easy to get distracted by everything that's going on around us. The hustle and bustle of life tends to keep us from the things that are truly important as followers of Christ. While there's simply no substitute for the personal reading of God's Word, programs like Building on the Solid Rock are a huge blessing that God uses in the discipleship of countless people. Building on the Solid Rock is the radio ministry of Pastor Troy Neely of Calvary Chapel Solid Rock in San Antonio, Texas. For more information about our ministry or to access the archive of messages, log on to our website at www.buildingonthesolidrock.com. You can subscribe to our podcast while you're there or search for us in the iTunes store under Calvary Chapel Solid Rock. It's absolutely free. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us. We invite you to join us again next time as we continue our verse-by-verse study through the Gospel of Matthew. That's next time on Building on the Solid Rock.
I wonder why. And I look up and see the hand that I turned from when the storm began, and it covers me.